This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Corporate Service Supply and Manufacturing, a DJI Enterprise dealer providing DJI equipment and support for law enforcement, public safety, construction, and other commercial users of unmanned aerial systems. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/css. And by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/goengineer. You're listening to episode 261 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Max.
Yes, we're recording on the front side of the day instead of the back side, and it's quite a bit different when you're recording in the morning. It feels different, doesn't it, David?
Oh yeah, we're so out of sorts, you know. You get into these routines where we do this on a specific time every week, and today we're doing it a little differently. And both Max and I are out of sorts, so just be prepared for a very interesting podcast. But we got a lot of good news. Ryanair CEO says pilot airplanes could become reality, and more top news. Skyward works to redefine UTM. Hoverfly introduces a new tethered live sky sentry drone. This is a little bit out of date, but it's still important, which was the New York Police Department looking to the skies for drones during UN meetings. And the FAA Reauthorization Act was signed into law. So we'll keep that going. And then we've got a runaway Joey in Florida that was captured by a UAV. So with that, let's get started. Well, our first story comes from LinkedIn.com. Novartis to cut 500 UK jobs, and Ryanair CEO says pilotless aircrafts are going to happen. Now, if you listen to our other show, Airplane Geeks, one of our favorite people to talk about out of everybody is Ryanair's Michael O'Leary. The man says things like you wouldn't believe, but this was kind of interesting because he's always looking to save some money, and eliminating pilots from the cockpit would be one way.
Yeah, he says something that we tend to say a lot, I think, is that maybe this will all start with cargo flights. But to start it off, though, first he sees that single pilot airplanes will become a reality. Generally now, of course, we have two pilots in an airplane, commercial airplanes we're talking about here. And as O'Leary notes, we have the technology already to do that. But the next step, David, completely autonomous flights.
Yeah, well, we technically have the ability to do that too. But that's I don't know if he's really meaning autonomous or remotely piloted. I think there's a step there in between where when we say autonomous, that means that the aircraft flies itself. Whereas I think maybe the next step would be remotely piloted, where we would have two pilots located in a box somewhere flying like they would a Predator or a Reaper or a Global Hawk, whatever. It would be interesting to see what happens with an autonomous aircraft. And then, of course, there's the whole, how do you convince the general public that flying in an aircraft with no pilots is a safe thing to do?
Right, exactly. That's the obstacle to this that is pointed out in this article, in the source article, passenger fear. Although there's an interesting quote from O'Leary. He says, as an example to address that issue, an autonomous train service between terminals at Stansted Airport near London was launched in 1991. And for the first few weeks, passengers were afraid to get on the train with no driver at the front. Now, he says, no one bats an eyelid. So that's kind of an interesting point. But he also says that if you go pilotless on a commercial airplane, so we're all riding in a big passenger drone, that the reduction in manpower would lead to lower ticket prices, and that may be just enough to convince people to give it a try.
And for Leary, anything to lower ticket prices and increase his profit, he'll do it. So Ryanair will be the first, mark my words, will be the first pilotless airline.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, he doesn't think this is going to happen in the near term, right, David? He's talking like 40 to 50 years out. And the interesting thing about a completely autonomous commercial airplane 40 to 50 years out is you, me, and O'Leary, well, we'll be dead. So we won't know how accurate his prediction is.
Yeah, well, we're not going to live to see it, but we'll go on from there. But one of the most important things, if you're going to have autonomous airlines, is a universal traffic management system, or UTM, or unmanned traffic management system. And this is from expouav.com news. Skyward works to redefine UTM as universal traffic management. UTM means UAS traffic management. They're trying to broaden it to be universal, meaning, I would assume, Max, meaning that it commingles manned aviation with unmanned aviation.
That's right. And we heard from Mariah Scott, who's the president of Skyward, which is now a Verizon company. And she testified at a recent hearing of the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Aviation. And she made this point that let's not think of it as UAS traffic management. Let's think of it, like you say, as universal traffic management. She's says we should think of UTM as a system of systems or an environment where all aircraft, manned, unmanned, remotely piloted, autonomous, whatever, together safely share the airspace. And that logic is kind of appealing to me, David, carving out unmanned and saying, well, we're going to have this separate system which would interconnect with manned aviation systems. I mean, that's kind of the flavor, I think, of what we've been seeing so far. But to think of it in this broader way where it's all one system or a collective system that applies to manned, unmanned, and everything in between, it's kind of appealing.
And it makes sense. I think it's a natural progression that it would happen anyway to begin with. Scott said in an interview, we have a unique opportunity to learn from other regulated markets and technology. We know that systems that work have global standards and regulatory framework to promote interoperability and rapid adaptation. So computer standards, automobile standards, all of those, we're back to setting the standards for everybody here. So, I mean, that kind of makes sense.
And she also addressed the topic of remote identification, something we'll cover a little bit coming up when we talk about the FAA reauthorization. But she noted that balancing the interests of the various stakeholders for a satisfactory remote ID policy has proved difficult. The technology is here. There are reasonable solutions to questions of privacy, authentication, and applicability of a remote ID rule. And the FAA knows that after the remote ID arc last year, she says, we are finally seeing alignment from Congress around the need to apply a remote ID standard to all remote pilots in the national airspace. She also said to think about remote ID on drones as equivalent to license plates on vehicles. And that's how she kind of addressed that topic to the hobbyists who say, well, why do I have to have a remote ID on my hobbyist drone? And her analogy is vehicles, automobiles, trucks, all of that, where you have license plates on those. Of course, there are some smaller vehicles, quote unquote, that don't require license plates, I guess. And maybe the analogy should continue on to drones, where there are some, you know, micro drones and some level of hobbyist drones that maybe don't really need remote ID.
When was the last time you put a driver's license, a license plate on a bicycle?
Yeah, exactly. There's the example.
So, well, I don't know. When I was a little kid, we had little license plates for our bicycles, but they were fake. But
that's right.
I date myself. Well, it's going to be an interesting fight, but I think remote ID is coming to everybody, whether they want it or not. Next one is from UASmagazine.com. Hoverfly introduces new tethered live sky sentry drones. I kind of like these tethered drones, Max. That always I find intriguing. Hoverfly manufactures tethered power drones, unlimited flight time, persistent drones, applications, public safety, sporting events, and security. Their new Live Sky Sentry is an all-weather military-grade UAS. And of course, tethered means that you have a line that runs from the aircraft down to the ground that provides the power as well as any of the data information that the sensors pick up.
Yeah, well, I remember when we first started talking about tethered drones years ago, David, and I think the first application was an attempt to get away from the drone regulations or requirements at the time by saying that, no, it's like a kite. You know, you don't regulate kites. You don't regulate tethered balloons to the same degree. So if we just tie a string to our drone, that you know, we can avoid all this FAA stuff. But it's become more and more clear that there are these other kinds of applications where, you know, a persistent presence up in the sky might be just the thing, either permanently or semi-permanently or short-term to keep an eye on an accident scene or a natural disaster or something of that sort. But as you mentioned, David, this thing is all-weather military grade. It meets some interesting standards that make this useful in a variety of adverse weather conditions.
It's a package. It's not just, I mean, with a tethered drone, you're not just getting, you have to have a base station to go with the drone. And it can be operated from a fixed base ground stations off of moving vehicles. The Skybox Precision Landing Platform, either enclosed or uncovered, can operate autonomously from the back of a pickup truck. They also have a mobile tether kit that can integrate with the landing nest. So it's kind of interesting, like it can be like a kite where you're driving along with a truck and you can be flying the drone as the truck's moving, which is kind of an interesting way to handle the situation. You've got, and you won't ever lose control of the drone because you're permanently attached to it.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the use cases would be for a tethered drone on a moving vehicle. You know, that would suggest maybe you are trying to keep an eye in the sky on the vehicle itself, or on some group of vehicles that were traveling together. I'm not sure exactly what you'd use that for, but it is kind of an interesting, and you would have to, I don't know, consider things like wind and the vehicle turning and, you know, pulling the cable from different directions and so forth. So that seems like it would present some kind of unusual challenges to manage the position of the drone, but it's interesting nonetheless. But as far as the standards, the specs, the Live Sky Sentry, it's designed to meet IP54 standards. Those are for extreme weather conditions. But it also meets MIL Standard 810, which is for U.S. military environmental test requirements. So a pretty robust device. Not sure what the price is offhand, David, but I bet it's not inexpensive.
Yeah, you're not going to purchase this one off the shelf. Let's just say that. But maybe a tethered drone would have been useful in the UN General Assembly meetings. And this was from NewYorkPost.com. New York Police Department looking to the skies for drones during UN meetings. The General Assembly, which of course is a very large big deal where the world comes to Manhattan to go to the UN, were going to be monitoring in case of drones for terrorist attacks and other events. So they were keeping active with that, though the Post does report that the New York Police Department didn't say what exactly they were doing. And now that this is a bit of an older news story, I don't think there was any events that involved drones during the assembly.
I don't recall hearing any, but I think what was on the mind of the New York Police Department trying to provide security for this event was the attempted assassination of the Venezuelan president in August. And you'll remember that there were, I guess, a couple of drones involved, David, with some explosives. And that was kind of a wake-up call, I think, for a lot of security organizations, public safety organizations, as to, you know, what might be possible. And I guess the New York Police Department responded to that concern in some way. I'd love to know exactly how and what they plan to do if they encountered some kind of a drone that presented a threat.
For every good operation, there's a bad operation, but we try to keep this on the good news part. Well, this week in FAA news, the FAA Reauthorization Act allows government to control and confiscate drones, and as we record this, the bill has been signed into law. So I guess let's do a deep dive into the FAA reauthorization bill. What do you think, Max?
Sure. Well, one relates back to what we were just talking about. Previously, authorities needed a warrant in order to seize your drone, right? Your property. If they're going to take it, they need a warrant to do that. But under the FAA Reauthorization Act, the authorities are allowed to confiscate or shoot down your drone if they consider it to be a threat. Now, of course, the first question comes to mind is, what kind of a threat? What's the definition of a threat? Who gets to determine whether or not a particular drone is a threat? And a couple of the organizations that that monitor these kinds of issues, well, they're not too happy with this.
Like, let's start off with the American Civil Liberties Union. The provisions give the government virtually carte blanche to surveil, seize, or even shoot a drone out of the sky, whether owned by journalists or by commercial entities, with no oversight or due process. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation said, quote, if lawmakers want to give the government the power to hack or destroy private drones, then Congress and the public should have the opportunity to debate how best to provide adequate oversight and limit those powers to protect our right to use drones for journalism, activism, and recreation.
So I think valid concerns.
Yeah, I think they're thinking broader than just the private drone operator with a threat. Both of them have commented on journalism, which is a high discussed topic in our current political climate. I guess, Max, what's going to happen is someone's going to shoot down a drone, and then we will start having case law.
Yeah, and that's typically what happens when you have legislation enacted into law that maybe doesn't specify in great detail how it's to be applied. And as you say, somebody challenges it, the courts get involved, try to understand what the intent of Congress was in enacting the legislation. And so, we may be in a period that could last quite a long time before this is completely clarified. But it's certainly an interesting issue that comes out of the Authorization Act, the Reauthorization Act. But it does some other things. It authorizes the FAA to establish a remote identification solution. So there's work on that. And the AMA has had a little bit of, some preliminary comments on the authorization bill. And I guess what we have here, David, is now section 349 kind of covers the issues that had previously been specified by 336. So I guess this is the new section for recreational use.
This isn't as bad as I think the AMA was expecting it to be. There'll be links to the show notes, and you can reach that at theuavdigest.com/261. And some of the things the AMA were in section 349 had pointed out was AMA members should continue to fly in accordance with AMA safety guidelines, as we have for decades. Existing agreements between AMA clubs and the FAA are still valid and should be followed until further notice. That was good news for the AMA.
Yes, absolutely. And they also say that they note that Congress more clearly defines community-based organizations, or CBOs, and tasks the FAA to recognize CBOs. So that's what we've had in the past, right? Community-based organizations that set rules for recreational flying, and the Academy of Model Aeronautics has been one of those in the past. They note that these CBOs, community-based organizations, like the AMA, have a more prominent role in shaping future regulations. And that's a good thing. The authorization bill also codifies some elements of AMA's safety programming. Now that's part of the law, including the use of first-person view. That's good. There's a change to the 5-mile airport notification rings. It looks like those have been removed, David.
Which, according to the thing, which was burdensome and often misinterpreted mandate placed on our hobby. I want to see how this plays out, Max, because the 5 miles has always been such a huge discussion point for the FAA and the notification thereof. I'm sort of surprised that this is. Maybe they're going to reduce the rings to maybe 1 mile or 2 miles. I don't know. I haven't looked at my know before your fly app on my phone to see if I'm actually now in a safe zone to fly my drone or not.
Well, if you look at the section in the bill there, it seems to talk more about the class of airspace. It says in class B, C, and D airspace, or within the lateral boundaries of the surface area of Class E airspace designated for an airport, the operator obtains prior authorization from the administrator or designee before operating and complies with all airspace restrictions and prohibitions. So it looks like it's sort of airspace class-based rather than just, you know, here's 5 miles. Also, it says that in Class G airspace, the aircraft is flown not higher than 400 feet AGL, and there's some other requirements in here as well. So, again, we'll have a link to that section. This is section 349. It's the exception for limited recreational operations of unmanned aircraft, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
We've talked about elephants. We've talked about whales. We've talked about cougars. Well, in the menagerie of animals that we've talked about on UAV Digest, let's now add kangaroos. And really what's interesting about this story was it wasn't Australia, it was Florida. This is from clickorlando.com. Drones help search for runaway kangaroo in Florida. A kangaroo in South Florida named Storm escaped and a search was organized. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation officers used 2 drones to help search. Storm was located and is now back safe at her home. The drones were used as a broad search by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. We've talked about them before because they were using drones for surveying the Florida Everglades and doing animal searching. So I guess they used them to locate poor Storm hopping around the neighborhood.
Yeah, this is, we talked about, you know, searching using drones. Usually it's for people, But in this case, we have a kangaroo, and I'm not sure how he escaped. I'm not sure if Storm escaped as a result of the storm down there, the hurricane, or just found his own way out.
He hopped the fence.
He hopped the fence. Of course he did. He's back home now, which is good, because I don't think you really want a kangaroo loose in the neighborhood. And so bringing the drones to bear, I think we'll continue to see more and more law enforcement agencies, public service agencies adding drones to the arsenal of their tools to use in certain situations. And here we have a good one.
Well, we have a video of the week, Max, albeit depressing, in my opinion.
Well, we always wonder what happens when a drone hits an aircraft in flight. We contemplate the disaster that may occur, or we think that this plastic drone is just going to explode into thousands of little pieces and, of course, destroy the drone, but do little damage to the aircraft. There's been some research, but not a lot. But this is an interesting video. This comes from the University of Dayton Research Institute's Impact Physics Lab. And they conducted tests in order to simulate what happened when a drone strikes an airplane in flight. They're looking for a 238-mile-an-hour contact speed. So they got themselves a DJI Phantom 2, and they launched it into the wing of a Mooney M20 aircraft. And the video is, well, it isn't what I expected to see, David. I thought the Phantom would, as I said, turn into a lot of little tiny pieces, but that's not what it did.
Nope. It punched the leading edge of the wing and entered the wing structure and damaged the wing spar, which would be probably a catastrophic failure if the wing spar got damaged.
I was just amazed at how this Phantom went through the aluminum on the Mooney and caused that damage. So we'll have a link to the video in the show notes. Take a look at it. The video is titled, Are Drones Dangerous? And you can draw your conclusions by watching the video.
Well, Max, I think we should wrap this up. What do you think?
All right. We want to thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. This has been episode 261. You can find us at the UAVDigest.com, where we've got show notes for all the episodes. And if you'd like to go straight to the show notes for this particular episode, you can visit the UAVDigest.com/261.
And of course, you can find us on social media at the UAVDigest.com or Twitter at UAVDigest. On Facebook, facebook.com/UAVDigest. And, of course, you can become part of our Slack listener team and enjoying the conversation. And you do that by going to our website, which is theuavdigest.com/team. Or you can send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And, of course, using that email address, you can also send us your videos of the weeks or any news stories that you might want us to follow up on. We always look forward to having letters and emails from our listeners, and we do our best to try to answer every one of them. And of course, you can do us a favor and leave us some feedback on whatever podcaster you use, Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Stitcher.com. And you could purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store, which is, and those links, all of those links you can find on our show notes. And don't forget to check out all the conferences that are available on our website. And with that, I guess I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.